It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Under Pennsylvania law, police officers are justified in using deadly force when they believe it necessary to prevent death or serious injury to themselves or others, or if they believe it necessary to prevent a suspect's escape from arrest for a suspected felony. Defense attorney Patrick Tomasi successfully used that argument in the acquittal of former police officer Michael Rossfeld in the fatal shooting of 17-year-old Antoine Rose. That acquittal has led to a calling for reform of the use of force laws in Pennsylvania. Joining us now on the line is State Representative Ed Gainey, a Democrat from East Liberty. Representative, welcome to The Confluence.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
I am well, sir. Hope you are as well. Representative, the jury only took a little more than 3 hours to acquit Michael Rossfeld. They saw the video of Antoine Rose being shot in the back 3 times while fleeing, but they heard the defense's argument and their use of force experts citing state law. Do you think the jury was put in a quandary? They know what they saw, but...
Well, I think, you know, all law is always open to interpretation, and we know that. The reality is when we're talking about use of force, we know at a state level that we have to strengthen some of the law so this never happens again. So I don't want to say they was put in a quandary because I don't want to say where they were at. But from what I've seen, and I'm not a juror, I'm just a state representative, but from what I'm seeing, it was obvious he caused no threat to them. There was no threat that he caused. This was a gentleman that was running from the scene, and he got 3 shots in the back. He was unarmed. Everybody, whether you were a juror or not, seen the coverage of that and seen that he did not have a weapon, nor did it appear that he had a weapon in his hand. And so there was no fear for your life if you don't have a weapon in your hand. Now, from the legal perspective, we know in Harrisburg, my colleagues and I are working on some bills right now to deal with use of force. And when we're finished, we will be rolling them out. Summer Lee is one of them, myself, Jake Wheatley, Austin Davis, and also some representatives from Philadelphia. So there's a host of representatives that understand what happened and want to make the necessary changes to ensure that we're improving humanity inside the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. But in regards to the case and the quandary, I don't want to speak to that. But what I will speak to is that it was clear that there's no way that I've seen or anyone who's seen the tape, who had an opportunity to witness that tape, could ever say that the gentleman was in fear for his life.
What do you say when police supporters indicate that cops have to make split-second decisions?
Well, you know, one, we want all our law enforcement officers to come home, just like we want our family members to come home. And at the end of the day, you know, you're also trained to be able to look at certain things. And we understand that, you know, some things are just split-moment decisions, but there's also the rule of de-escalation and how well your training is to de-escalate something. If a gentleman is running away from you and you shoot him in the back 3 times, I don't see where you practice de-escalation at all. Matter of fact, it was more aggression than de-escalation because the gentleman is running from you. So even if we say, well, you got a split moment, there was more than a split moment at that moment to make a decision. Mm-hmm. It's not as if he was coming at him. It's not as if he pointed a gun at him. It's not as if he was running at him. He was running away from him unarmed. So even though they have a decision to make in that moment, that split moment of time, in this incident, that split moment of time didn't exist because the gentleman was fleeing. The officer's life was not in jeopardy.
You and your House colleagues, Austin Davis, Summer Lee, Jake Wheatley, you mentioned earlier, along with County Councilman DeWitt Walton and City Councilman Daniel Lavelle, issued a statement shortly after the verdict, saying in part, quote, "Unfortunately, there'll be no justice for Antoine. This outcome, while extremely disappointing, is far from surprising. Our region has a troubling history of racial injustices," end quote. Are you saying the verdict is not surprising because it was an African-American teen shot by a white officer, or because the language in the use of force law is kind of broad?
I'll answer that. So here's my take on it. Mm-hmm. All throughout the United States, we have seen throughout these years of young black males being killed at the hands of officers. That's not nothing that's make-believe. That's things that we've seen on the news. You yourself have seen it on the news. I've seen it. And it's troubling. It's troubling that sometimes we see de-escalation in certain events and then aggression in others. And so, yeah, we can look at the law, and we already talked about looking at the law and seeing what changes we have to make. But we also have to look at the heart of people, too, and understand that in certain situations, you can take that split moment that you discussed and de-escalate some things. And we didn't see that in the Antoine Rose. We didn't see that in some of the other things that occurred with some African-American males and the police. So the feeling is that every time something like this happens, based on the historical contents going back from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and even to 2000, when it comes to police-community relations, there's always been a situation that when we talk about any type of brutality being played out on TV, on social media, or whatever, you can see for yourself why we feel that way. This is not something new. This has been going on for decades. And so, yeah, it begins to hurt your heart when you see that. It begins to ask you, why, why? Why a guy fleeing the scene unarmed is shot three times in the back? Yeah, we feel that way. Everyone that calls herself an American that wants justice should feel that way. Richard, we don't want to put it in a situation where the police are in jeopardy, and we don't want to put it in a situation where our community is in jeopardy. We don't want that. What we want is some form of justice. We don't want to continue to have to keep having the same conversation over and over again, and everybody says it's going to get better, but when we look at it, we can't see any progress. Nobody should want that.
Representative Reggie Shuford, the executive director of the ACLU of Pennsylvania, has called for changes to Pennsylvania law requiring police departments to release their use of force policies, make them transparent. Will that help at all, or do you need to change the law of what an officer can and cannot do in a certain situation, that such as the Michael Rosfeld shooting of Antoine Rose?
Well, I haven't seen what he put out, so for me to comment would be kind of premature without me viewing exactly what he said or his proposal. I don't want to comment on what I have no knowledge of. I'm not going to do that. We at the state have a responsibility to do all we can to deal with this use of force law and make sure that we're making it to where it saves lives and improves communities, community relations with the police. We have an obligation to do that. Whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, you have an obligation to do that because we know that makes for a better society. So my focus right now is how do we create a better law? And again, I'm working with my colleagues to do that, and we will be coming out with something shortly, but we just want to make sure that we got it right. So we want to talk to some people to make sure we're going in the right direction. But the reality is this has to stop.
You say you want to talk to other people. At least two other states are looking at changing their use of force laws, California and Maryland. Will you talk to them? Will you sort of get their insights of how they're going down this road?
Well, we're definitely reaching out. Now, we have not reached out to California or Maryland, but we have taken, at least I have taken a look. That's how, when you said Maryland, I knew what you were going to say. We have taken a look, and we're including all that. But right now, until we get it right, I'm not going to speak on it until it's ready to go.
Okay.
When it's ready to go, I'll come back on there and talk about it.
We would invite you back. Maryland seems to have some greater changes. Do these ideas at least interest you? If the officer uses deadly force, he must believe he's protecting his own life or others based on some things. If the deceased person has a deadly weapon, if the officer first tried to de-escalate the situation, which you were talking about earlier, and whether the officer's prior conduct in other incidents resulted in a need for deadly force. Did any of those things sort of pique your interest?
Well, let me go past the last one. You said the officer would say that last part again.
Yes. If the officer's prior conduct resulted in a need for deadly force. So they're looking at the officer's record, if you would. Did any of those points interest you?
Well, of course, the officer's record. If you're bouncing from police force to police force, there's a problem. and we know that. And there's a bill that's coming out that deals with that as well. And we are looking at that. And de-escalation should always be the first, always be the first. Listen, I'm amazed. You know what I mean? You want to talk about a stark contrast. Let's talk about it from this one. You got a gentleman that walks in with an AR-15 into a synagogue and does a horrific, kills 11 people, a horrific, but he walks out in handcuffs. He got an AR-15. You got a guy that's running, and gets three in the back. Where was the de-escalation in that?
That legislation that you were referring to about hiring one officer that ran into trouble in another police department, the bill introduced or being proposed by your colleague from Philadelphia, Representative Chris Rabb.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think, does it ultimately come down to the training of officers? Even if you have use of force policies, how they are trained to enforce those policies?
Absolutely. You know that. Absolutely. And I'm glad you said that. I thank you, because you're absolutely correct. Training, we need training, but we need more than training. We need accountability. We need to be able to make sure that if something goes wrong that didn't have to go wrong, like in the case of Antoine Rose, that there's justice that is served. So I agree with you 100% that we need training, but we also need accountability. Because accountability is what's going to fix the issue at the end of the day. And that's the number one thing that we've been talking about. We have to hold people accountable for their actions.
Very briefly, of just about 10 seconds, sir, do you have an idea when we might expect some legislation officially introduced into the House by you, your colleagues? Very briefly.
I would say in the next week. Next week. It should be there. We're working on it right now. We're just finishing up a couple things, and we want to do a package. So it's being worked on as we speak.
All right. State Representative Ed Gainey from East Liberty, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. It's been more than 3 months since a fire at U.S. Steel's Clairton Coke Works significantly increased emissions of sulfur dioxide, impacting the daily lives of Mon Valley residents. How does sulfur dioxide affect the human body? We'll explore that in our new series, Moment of Science. Tens of thousands of jobs across the region, many of which don't require a bachelor's degree, will be up for grabs in the coming years. There's a new push to get students interested in trades from construction to manufacturing to energy. But is there social stigma attached to these jobs? Get conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
Rap music made great strides in the early 1980s. Curtis Blow earned the first gold record in the genre for The Breaks, and the Sugar Hill Gang introduced hip-hop to the top 40 for the first time with Rapper's Delight. However, the first song to hit number one and include a rap was not necessarily by a rapper. It wasn't even a rap song. Blondie's Rapture hit number one on this date in 1981 thanks to frontwoman Debbie Harry and her rhymes about a man from Mars who likes to eat. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
When a reactor at the Three Mile Island Nuclear Generating Station partially melted down 40 years ago this week, Chuck Kern lived and worked nearby. And he kept an audio diary of the historic event. This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsapple. When he started his recording on a handheld device, Chuck Kern was a controller and personnel manager for a local bedding manufacturer near Harrisburg. He heard about the accident at work.
I was shocked. I was scared.
Kern listened to news updates on the radio and tried to make calls to the company's retail stores, but the phones were tied up and he couldn't even get a dial tone. 40 years later, Kern is a forensic accountant and talking about his experience. What were your initial thoughts about it?
I was 33 at the time. Not too many years out of graduate school and all that sort of thing. And the belief was at the time, and I was young, so anything new was good, and anything old was just people being old fuddy-duds. I was probably, and I'm not saying I'm not a proponent of nuclear power now. I'm just saying that at the time, all the publicity was quite favorable. When you're faced with, part of the problem was the coverage at the time. You had the people from the utility company saying one thing. You had Denton from the Atomic Energy Commission saying exactly the opposite. And then you had the governor, Thornburg, coming up and admitting that he actually didn't know who was right and who wasn't.
Yeah, you were told, the public was told by the media that there had been a high level of radiation release sometime after the incident. Then officials with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission said, no, everything's okay, but people should stay indoors. Here's what you said about it then.
They just responded with terms and so forth that were technical and just beyond the comprehension of anybody. They get into discussions of millirams and megarams and rams and rams per hour.
You know, it's you're trying to believe people who are on the radio who are authorities, but you don't really know, and they're not saying the same thing. They're conflicting. And if there is radiation, I think I probably knew or thought I knew that, you know, it does penetrate buildings. It does penetrate walls.
In the end, the government says the amount of radiation released during the Three Mile Island accident never exceeded unacceptable levels. But Chuck Kern, like many others in the area, ended up evacuating for a few days until they felt sure they were out of danger. Then they returned, and life went on. Do you think that we have learned something from that accident?
Well, yes, I do. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. Nothing is foolproof. You know, it reminds me, when you ask that question, like one thing we see in the news a lot about lately is driverless automobiles. Well, have you ever heard about a computer glitch? Okay, well, those cars are going to have accidents. No system, I'm sure, is foolproof. And, you know, I think most human beings are pretty well intended. But things will happen, things will go wrong. And that's the nature of life.
Chuck Kern kept an audio diary of his thoughts as events around the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island were unfolding in March of 1979. There's more of our conversation and coverage of the 40th anniversary of the accident at AlleghenyFront.org. That's the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsapple.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. It's been more than 3 months since a fire at U.S. Steel's Clairton Coke Works significantly increased emissions of sulfur dioxide. Mon Valley residents say it's affecting their quality of life.
It's still at times pretty bad. Certain mornings and in the night, it's really bad all the time. My wife has a bad heart, and it causes her a lot of breathing problems.
It comes right in your house. Your whole house just fills up with it. Every room. There's no getting away from it.
I know nothing, really. But I know that sometimes I can't breathe as well. Some days it's an awful toxic smell. And it's not every day, but the result is black soot on my porch, in my house. But I am concerned. Tell me about sulfur dioxide then.
That was Jim Ross of Clairton, Frank Walk of Portview, and Esther Spadaro of Clairton. As part of our new occasional series, A Moment of Science, 90.5 WESA's Liz Reed talked with University of Pittsburgh public health professor Jim Fabisak about how sulfur dioxide affects the human body.
What happens when sulfur dioxide is inhaled?
Essentially, it can combine with water to produce microscopic droplets of sulfuric acid.
And it's basically just interacting with all the water that is in your body.
All of the water that is on the sort of surfaces that are exposed to the environment.
So your eyes, your airway, your
airways
lungs.
Gets to be one of the most important ones, because this gas, as it's inhaled, can act as a severe irritant to those tissues.
There's another way that it interacts with our bodies, and that's when it becomes particulate matter in the atmosphere. Can you explain how that works?
In the same way, sulfur dioxide can interact with water vapor that's in the atmosphere. and also be converted to small droplets of sulfuric acid. We know from a variety of health effect studies that particulate matter, as measured in a very general way, is associated with increased risk of cardiovascular events, premature mortality, enhanced respiratory effects as well, exacerbations of chronic obstructive lung disease, even adverse birth outcomes.
What do we know about what's happening in the body that leads to these outcomes?
Well, that's somewhat controversial, and there are several theories that have been put forth. One is that the irritation to the lungs by these particulates causes neural reflexes that affect the autonomic nervous system.
And what's the autonomic nervous system?
The sort of nervous system that's responsible for controlling your heart rate, your breathing rate, gastrointestinal motility, things
that... All the processes we don't think about.
Exactly.
You don't have to say, I'm going to digest this apple.
Exactly. And then that has effects on your heart rate. And if you have pre-existing cardiovascular disease, then that change in autonomic tone to your heart could push you a little bit in the direction of having an adverse event, an arrhythmia, something like that.
What is still unknown about the health effects of particulate matter?
One of the things that's unknown is trying to dissect out the mechanism. How do we account for some of the adverse effects that particulate matter that are beginning to emerge, such as the adverse birth outcomes? There's even some work that talks about increased risk of autism. The other is that particulate matter is very heterogeneous in terms of its composition and where it comes from. And so trying to determine which specific forms of that particulate matter are the most responsible for the adverse effects is also sort of a topic of research.
Thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure being here.
That was Pitt Environmental Health Professor Jim Fabisak speaking with 90.5 WESA's Liz Reed. And Liz joins us in studio now. Hello, Liz.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
All right. So a moment of science, an occasional series. So what's the purpose behind it?
Well, we're looking to illuminate the science behind the headlines. You know, science is all around us, from the way potholes form to how opioids affect the brain to the sometimes irrational decisions we make as consumers. And I've personally always been curious about why things are the way they are, in this new series gives us a chance to stop and ask those questions.
Well, you've given a couple of examples of something that can be very complicated science and something that is just everyday, a pothole. And so that's kind of fun about it.
Yeah, I think that's what's fun because, like I said, science is everywhere. And there's, you know, if we dig down further, there's always a reason why the sky is blue, for example.
Well, I mentioned fun, but sometimes science can be kind of heavy. How do you make it? How are you going to make these stories, these reports, user friendly?
Well, I think, you know, I spent a while doing science reporting here at WESA. Right. There's a couple of tricks that I have when talking to scientists. One, I ask them to speak to me like I'm a very precocious fifth grader. You know, I think kids, for example, can grasp complex topics, but they don't know all the jargon. And regular people often don't know the jargon. So you'll hear I interrupted Jim in that last segment to ask him to describe the autonomic nervous system. Most of us don't remember that from high school biology,
I would imagine.
The other thing is metaphors are helpful. But I think if we can just take a few minutes, break things down, most people can understand what we're talking about.
Some upcoming topics? Do you have many planned or at least rolling around in your head?
Yeah, so it's tax season, as many of us know.
Thanks a lot.
I still need to file mine. So we're going to be looking at the psychology behind people's preference for a big tax return versus just lower withholding throughout the year. Most of us basically give the IRS an interest-free loan every year. Why do we do that? And then there's another weird kind of fun one coming up, depending on your definition of fun, I guess. We get these notices from the county to our newsroom every time a rabid animal is caught.
Yes.
So we're
yes.
going to be looking at what rabies actually is, what it does in the body, and what might happen if it went untreated in a human.
Yeah, we were, you know, we would hear, I mean, years ago, we hear about rabies. It was like, oh my goodness, stay away. You know, it could be death if you don't get, treated immediately.
Right,
So You know, WESA listeners are aware of our Good Question series about Pittsburgh. Will you accept questions from listeners for a moment of science?
Yes, absolutely. I would love to hear what you want to know about topics in the news or about things that are sort of seasonal about or about things you see around Pittsburgh that you wonder, you know, what's the science between why things are that way. You can shoot me an email at lreid, that's R-E-I-D, at WESA.FM.
Very good. Liz Reed is a WESA editor and reporter and heading up this new project, A Moment of Science. Liz, thanks so much.
Thank you, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
WYP celebrates Women's History Month throughout March. Today, find out more about Alison Moyet. Alison Moyet got her start in the English pub and punk rock scene in the late 1970s, but is best known for her work in the synth-pop duo Yaz in the 80s and her 9 studio albums. Moyet has sold over 23 million records worldwide, along with 2 million singles, and has been nominated for a Grammy Award, Mercury Prize, and several Brit Awards. The 90s were a period of success, but also hiatus and struggle. Alison Moyet fought her label, Sony Records, for close to 8 years to seek more artistic control with her music and career. Moyet has been involved with many projects over the years, working with Dave Stewart, Tricky, Kirsty MacColl, and the Lightning Seeds. To hear full songs from our featured artists for Women's History Month, go to wyp.org/women.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pittsburgh region faces a shortfall of 80,000 qualified workers by 2025, and many of those require less than a bachelor's degree. That's according to a study by the Allegheny Conference on Community Development. Tomorrow at the David L. Lawrence Convention Center, more than 4,000 7th through 12th graders are expected to get a close look at potential careers in construction, energy, manufacturing, and other trades. Angela Mike is the executive director of the Career and Technical Education Division of Pittsburgh Public Schools. Eric Heasley is the executive director of the A.W. Beatty Career Center, which partners with 9 school districts in the North Hills. Welcome to The Confluence.
Thank Good morning. You.
So organizers are calling this Build On gathering the largest, most interactive skilled careers exploration ever in Western Pennsylvania. Are these industries, the companies within the different industries, are they getting more proactive, more even aggressive in recruiting future potential employees than they have in the past? Angela, we'll start with you.
I would say definitely yes, because of the need, and Eric and I both know that the forecast for construction jobs just in our Pittsburgh region alone is to increase by 4.6% by 2027. And we've been had a lot of outreach from employers around our career and technical education students and them being prepared to go to work immediately after high school. In fact, I think they're trying to grab a lot of them before they even get out of high school in their senior year, and Eric can add to that.
Correct. We work with a number of employers. We're aware of students on co-op and internships. And also, we're working, those employers are working with us. We've begun programs in our districts as young as the fifth grade. So we're spending time on career exploration with fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth graders so that they're able to touch some hands-on equipment at that young age and through summer camps, because we know in this area that there is such a demand. So we are all trying to work together to fill positions.
You said work together. So is that partnership, has that improved over the years where you are working together with the industries?
Yes, it definitely has. Folks are in our building. We're going out to their training sites, taking students on field trips, working together, both with our public and private partners, independent folks, the trade unions. It needs to be a concerted effort across the region.
Angela?
I totally agree. We've also been on more field trips and have had offers
for more hands-on experiences to get students, like Eric said, actually engaged in learning what these careers could look like. And then also talking to students early. And that's why I'm so happy about the event tomorrow, that they've invited seventh graders, as the younger ones, so that they can also start to explore careers that they may have never seen or even thought about. And tomorrow will help them to explore and see what's available.
Yeah, and you know, I think maybe when you hear trades, maybe your perception or some people's perception is kind of limited. Construction, building, maybe plumbing. Just give us an idea of just how wide, how broad of an area, how many different industries are included.
Well, just as Angel and I were talking before we came in, we think that a lot of times folks get stuck on what they see when they're driving down the road, a building being built or their work being repaired, and not even thinking about all the other employment opportunities that fall within that area. The computer science folks, the accounting folks, the engineers on the backside that you don't see you out actually working in the field every day. So there's some tremendous opportunities layered throughout all of those careers that students and parents and families need to understand are going to be available in the region right now and in the future.
Angela and Eric, give us a sense of just within how you are training and working with and educating students you're currently dealing with, just the wide variety.
Yeah, huge variety. And we're both trying to make sure that in the career and tech programs in the high school that students are getting transferable skills, stackable credentials, so that they're able to be agile and to move fluidly through what the work environment is going to look like in the future, just not now, but also down the road. And they're going to need to be fluid and be able to move, because a lot of these skills are going to cross over between different areas. So the technology piece, we try to make sure we infuse that across all of our programs, because Eric said they may start at one end on a construction site. They may end up behind the scenes in an IT position, and that's possible in these fields.
Eric, how wide are the fields that you're teaching at Beatty?
Sure. So our HVAC program and our building construction program are nearing capacity for student enrollment, which has increased over the last 3 years. You know, the automotive industry for both collision and automotive repair, health science careers. We live in, you know, a big area for health and nursing sciences.
Is that still a demand?
It most definitely is. And we're looking at, you know, some additional programs coming on board in the future. And truly, we have seen over the last 3 years an increasing in enrollment. For students and families realizing that this is a viable opportunity. And also those students also have the opportunity for additional post-secondary ed also. No matter where you're going, you're going to have education continuing beyond high school. You're going to be in a constant learning mode as we continue to develop.
Is there a stigma about jobs in the trades? Oh, you're not going to college. Angela?
I would say that there was. I think that's starting to be a thing of the past. I think that people are more educated now around where the jobs will be. And, of course, none of us want dead-end roads for our students or for our young adults. So I think people are starting to pay more attention as there's been more of a highlight on career and technical education and the viable options in technical fields.
We're in a region today where everyone needs to take a look at and take a look at the future, look at the past and say, well, what can we do to prepare students? Our college debt for our young men and women today continues to grow. If a student can leave from a career center, from a traditional high school, receive a solid job offer to work in the trades, and then look at post-secondary opportunities from there where there's potentially some employer sponsorship to make that happen, it makes positive sense to me every day.
Do we have to change our definition of success? It's not necessarily a BA degree. It's not necessarily a master's degree. Do we have to change that definition?
I think we do. I think we have to look at there's different pathways to getting to success or career success. And that can happen a number of ways. It can happen through an apprenticeship program, cost-free. You leave with no debt. And students will be able to check that out tomorrow at the Build On Careers Fair. And then there's also where students may start in a career in tech program and then go on to post-secondary and have a job at the same time. So many different pathways to career success, and it just doesn't have to be to go straight into a four-year school.
You're making all your students aware about these possibilities to consider.
Correct.
Do you have to convince the parents as much as you do the students? Because, you know, let's face it, parents, oh, I want better for my kids than I had, and maybe that's more education than I had or whatever.
Well, what we're truly seeing over the last 3 to 5 years, parents beginning to look at a much younger age with their student. On our Career Center open houses, we're seeing a number of 7th and 8th graders already in the building looking at program offerings from their parents. And I look at those parents, and those parents grew up through the late 80s, early 90s when the steel mills were closing and things like that. And I think the parents are realizing it. There are some other opportunities out there. But and look at a cost of a traditional four-year college education. And then we do hear the fact that a number of times people are coming back with a four-year degree and then going on to look at a two-year degree at the local community colleges because they need that technical skill.
It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Tomorrow at the David L. Lawrence Convention Center, more than 4,000 7th through 12th graders are expected to get a close look at potential careers in the trades. And we're discussing that with Angela Mike from Pittsburgh Public Schools and Eric Heasley from A.W. Beatty Career Center. Is there too much emphasis in our schools on college readiness rather than career readiness?
I think really today we're talking a lot more about being college and career ready. You're going to be, for a number of areas, on a dual pathway, being prepared because there is going to be, there with the number of opportunities out there, there needs to be a blending of traditional skills, the technical skills, and the hands-on skills for a student to be successful. And that's truly what we're looking at. We want to make sure that our students stay here in the region, build the region, and then are able to also raise their family to stay here and continue that tradition.
Definitely. In fact, in Pittsburgh Public, our vision is for all of our students to be college, career, and life ready. So we are focusing on that, and we do have a comprehensive K-12 guidance plan that helps our students to explore a lot earlier. And those benchmarks are by 3rd grade, 5th grade, 8th, and 11th, making sure that they're exposed to many various career options. And again, I'll go back to tomorrow's event is going to be great because just in Pittsburgh Public alone, we're going to have over 1,000 students at the event tomorrow to explore. So we're looking forward to it.
All right. Oh, we have just about a minute and a half left. That report I cited from the Allegheny Conference a few minutes ago, it said effective career awareness and preparation is hampered by educators' lack of access to real-time jobs and skills data. Do you think you are getting the information that you need so that there's enough advance warning so that your students can prepare for a career and there's actually going to be an opening for them or a chance for an opening?
Most definitely. We work with those the folks from industry all the time, and they're providing us with those data numbers that then we are using back out. And I think, too, people are looking at the idea that we need to work together, and the information, putting educators in the workforce today really makes a difference on that also.
So tomorrow, what can attendees expect from the Build On event?
According to Jeff Novers and the Builders Guild, and want to thank Partner for Work for their support in making this happen also, and DeWitt Walton. But I think tomorrow students are going to have a hands-on experience to explore various construction careers.
And briefly, what are you looking for, Eric?
I think our students are excited for the opportunities to talk to some of the public utility companies to see all the offerings that they have and they're bringing to the table for them also.
Very good. Eric Heasley is the executive director of the A.W. Beatty Career Center, which partners with 9 school districts in the North Hills. Angela Mike is executive director of the Career and Technical Education Division of Pittsburgh Public Schools. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And for today, that is the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Tomorrow at this time, we present a special, I Remember 3 Mile Island. The Confluence returns Monday. We'll visit with Ann Craybill, director of the Westmoreland Museum of American Art. Their new exhibition explores a permanent, accurate record of Native peoples. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistants from Mick Stanelli, Julia Zenkovich, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.